Okay, so thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's an extremely interesting workshop. The title that was in the program was very pedantic, and this was in the hope that by being here for a few weeks, I would understand everything about tensor fusion categories, but actually I don't understand anything yet. So this is not the title of my talk. So I want to talk about tensor networks, symmetries, and topological order, and this is in many ways, somehow, a program that I started together with Ignacio Sirac a long time ago, and we are trying to understand many body physics from the point of view of entanglement theory. So we have many collaborators, but somehow the main people that from whom I learned somehow what I will talk tell in this talk are actually certainly Ignacio, but then also David Perez Garcia, Norbert Schuch, and then my students Burak, Dominic, Nick, and Michael. And so they certainly kind of are the ones who did most of the hard work of the talk that I want to give you. So this talk is in the numeric section, so I thought, well, at least I have to do some numerics. That's all the numerics you will see in the talk. So you can do numerics with tensor networks, and you can get really nice results. Okay, so like matrix product states, perhaps Mera, but that's all I want to say. What I want to talk about is the conceptual aspects. So conceptually, the whole idea is to model many body wave functions from the shadow world. Okay, so it's very very similar to somehow what Plato kind of envisioned. So what we want to see is basically how can we model the entanglement degrees of freedom that specify a state, a many body state. So it's a bit, you don't want to kind of specify all degrees of freedom. There must be some kind of underlying degrees of freedom that tell you how the correlations, how different regions are correlated with each other. And that's exactly the essence of these tensor networks, and that's exactly the essence of what we are trying to understand, and that actually Norbert explained already very nicely yesterday. So there's different aspects somehow basically that come into this. So on the one hand, we have area laws, the corner of Hilbert space. So somehow the amazing thing that actually somehow many body ground state of local Hamiltonians can be parameterized by a very small dimensional manifold. Okay, so that means that instead of doing the physics in the huge Hilbert space like you would do with exact angularization or something, no, you want to restrict yourself to work on a certain manifold that exactly kind of exhibits or captures the features that you want to get. It turns out that the area law exactly kind of gives a way of constructing systematically such manifolds, and then of course you want to do the physics on this manifold. And actually all these algorithms, as I will show you later, actually they are just kind of ways of integrating your evolution on these manifolds. Okay, so we have a low dimensional manifold and a huge dimensional Hilbert space. Well, project all the physics down to this and do the kind of physics. But what this talk is about is mostly about modeling the entanglement degrees of freedom in terms of symmetries. So we know that that phases are represented, or kind of many ways of classifying phases as symmetries. This dates certainly back to Landau. And it turns out that actually these tensor networks also give a very natural way of extending somehow this classification in terms of symmetries also to systems that are topological ordered. Okay, so Norbert talked about this yesterday somehow, and I want to go a little bit further and indeed kind of show you that. By looking at symmetries of local tensors, you can actually completely characterize the non-local, even somehow the phases that are kind of topological and therefore don't have any local order parameter. Okay, so what's the setup? I think most of you have seen matrix product states. So what is a matrix product state? It's a many body state. So we have a Hilbert space, we have a tensor product structure, and this tensor product structure, somehow wave function in this tensor product structure, you kind of just build up by putting blocks together, like basically tensors with three legs. These are the entanglement degrees of freedom, this is the physical degrees of freedom. You kind of just put these tensors next to each other. A red line means contract this index, and that's a many body wave functions. And I don't want to talk much about this because I'm sure that most of you have heard of it, but anyway, somehow it turns out that these matrix product states form a representation of the manifold of all states in one dimension that satisfy an area law, and this turns out to be exactly good enough to represent all ground states of one-dimensional local gapped Hamiltonians. Okay, and that's of course that's the reason why somehow DMRG and these things are so successful, because that's really, you can kind of completely characterize the manifold of low energy states. Okay, so that means that actually this matrix Bragg state formula allows for somehow an exponential compression of ground states in terms of a simple tensor. So you start with a many-body system with a Hilbert space that's exponentially large. It turns out that somehow you can represent any ground state using a simple tensor with three indices. Okay, and there's somehow the dimensions of these indices are just related to somehow the amount of entanglement you need. So how do all these kind of algorithms DMRG and come how the higher dimensional algorithms work? So you have this kind of manifold of low entanglement states, and you would like to kind of integrate the Schrödinger equation on that manifold. Well, what you do is instead of writing down the Schrödinger equation, you only put always before you kind of, when you kind of have h times psi, this takes you outside of the manifold, you just put back the projector. You project yourself back on the manifold, and that leads to some kind of a nice evolution on this manifold. And that's, of course, how you get nonlinear differential equations, due to this kind of projector. You start with a linear equation in a huge Hilbert space. You end up with kind of a nonlinear differential equation of somehow on your manifold. And all these methods, anything like DMRG and actually also the higher dimensional algorithms, are just different ways in which you can split somehow this kind of big differential equation. Okay, and it turns out that this is a very interesting way of doing. So, for example, in this talk that we heard before, this had to do with somehow these excitations, the fact that you can see these excitations. Well, you can understand perfectly what all these excitations are in terms of somehow tangent planes on terms of these manifolds. Anyway, that's somehow just to motivate the whole thing. So what's the two-dimensional versions of these matrix product states? Well, the two-dimensional versions turns out to be kind of parameterized by PEPs. So it's very similar to this one-dimensional version in which you had a line, but instead of like a three-index tensor, you use five-index tensors. And many of the kind of things that were true in one dimension go through here in two dimensions. So all these states that are now parameterized by this simple tensor, you again have an exponential compression, somehow they satisfy an area law. Okay, and so you can do now kind of, you can come up with two-dimensional analogs of DMRG, you evolve on the manifold of those states. It turns out that indeed any finite temperature Gibbs state of a local gapped Hamiltonian can be approximated by such kind of a state. But somehow this theorem about any state is certainly not true. So we don't have a good understanding yet which states these can really represent and which states we cannot represent using this. And there's a big discussion going on in the field about chiral states with chiral edge modes, whether somehow this is possible to represent using such kind of tensors or not. But anyway, so this talk is mainly about topological order. And so these matrix product states and these PEPs give you a very natural way of asking that question. It's really about somehow about the manifold. You see, it's all about the manifold of matrix product states or the manifold of PEPs. So the natural question is, for example, is the manifold of uniform matrix product states? That means that the tensors are all equal. Is this one connected manifold or is disconnected? Okay, so same thing in two dimensions. So these PEPs, is this one big manifold where every kind of state is connected with each other, or do we have disconnected ones? And then you can ask, what happens if you have symmetries? If you kind of include somehow, you take sections of this manifold where you say, I'll only look at states that have a certain global symmetry. So what happens to this manifold? And I think all of you basically know the answer. In 1D, if you have matrix product states, it's actually one big connected manifold. And you can prove that this is a complex scalar manifold. And therefore, you can really go from one state, from any ground state, to any other one, kind of via an adiabatic transformation. But if you impose a symmetry, that's exactly this whole business of SPT phases. So that means that you have one big connected manifold, but then you take a section through it because you only look at states with a certain symmetry, and then suddenly this falls into disconnected pieces. And that's, of course, why there's no adiabatic way from going from one side to the other side. Now, the two-dimensional version is much more interesting because there, even without symmetries, the whole manifold already kind of falls into disconnected parts. And these disconnected parts are exactly related to somehow the topological phases that you have. That's exactly why there is a topological phase, and you cannot go continuously from one to the other one. And then, of course, you can also add the global symmetry, and then it becomes actually much more fine-grained. So then you have the SPT, SET, from which we already heard many talks. So how can you start investigating these things in terms of these tensors, okay? Because that's the goal. We want to go to the shadow world in which somehow we look at the entanglement degrees of freedom instead of the physical degrees of freedom, yes?
Sorry, why aren't these spaces just vector spaces? Because it's just a collection of numbers combining all the tensors.
Yeah, but it's a Kähler manifold in the real Hilbert space, no? So
but the tensors themselves live in some vector space.
Yes, indeed, and there are kind of singularities in these kind of phases because somehow they are defined as products, as multilinear products in the thermodynamic limit of many, many things. And then there's some kind of singularities in these manifolds. That means that if you're, that actually has to do with the dimension of your of your entanglement, kind of entanglement degrees of freedom. Somehow, if you don't have the full support anymore on these virtual indices, you have a singularity in your manifold. But we can talk about this later. Exactly, exactly, and that's exactly where things. Yeah. Okay, so how do you prove these things, or how can you really kind of understand all these symmetries in a pretty straightforward way? It's really be something that we call the fundamental. It's a bit pedantic, but nevertheless, because it has so many applications, we call it the fundamental theorem of matrix product states. This has to do with, if you have two of these tensors, an A and a B, and I construct this kind of state in a thermodynamic limit, psi of A and psi of B, and these two things are kind of have some extra properties that are called injectivity, turns out that this thing is equal to this other one if and only if somehow there is a gauge transform that basically connects A to, this should be kind of B here, I have to apologize. This is AI is XBI, X minus one. So you see that this tensor A is equal to XB, X minus one. Okay, and it turns out that this whole business of classification, phase of matter using tensor network matrix product states 1 and 2D, it all follows from this very simple theorem. So let me kind of sketch this, how you do this in 1D. So this is an example that everybody knows, but I just want to kind of show how easy it is to do it in the language of matrix product states. So if you have a state with a global symmetry, okay, this could be, well, any symmetry, like for example, in the AKLT model, you could take some Z2 times Z2 symmetry that is related to somehow a subgroup of SO3. Somehow you take this symmetry group, and you know that if you act everywhere on the tensor with this symmetry, a global symmetry, you recover the same state. Okay, that means that this fundamental theorem is immediately applicable. It means that this tensor gives rise to the same state as the original one. That means that there must exist somehow another V, okay, some kind of a V and a VG minus one, such that this tensor is actually equal. So this means the state is equal, but this means that locally these two things have to be equal. Okay, and indeed you do the exercise for the AKLT model. You start with the symmetry and you see that actually these Vs are nothing more than the Pauli matrices. And the punchline of this whole kind of way of looking at things was discovered by Polman, Turner, Berg, and Oshikawa, and I think almost all of them are in the audience. This kind of Vs don't have to form a representation of the original group, but only a projective representation. Okay, and this has then led to a complete kind of way of classifying projective representations, because this leads to classification of 1D symmetry protected faces. This is work from Chen, Gu, and Wen, and then followed up by Shuch, Perez, Garcia, Sirac, and many other people. An immediate consequence, for example, is the degeneracy of the entanglement spectrum. So the entanglement spectrum is something that lives on this virtual space, and if you have a projective representation, of course, these representations have to be non-commutative, and therefore, somehow, these representations act non-trivially on this kind of space, and if something commutes with it, well, it leads to degeneracies. And that's exactly, I think, how Frank Polman and company, they really kind of discovered it by seeing that, indeed, the entanglement entropy is degenerate. Okay, so a very bright student of mine, Nick Bultink, just extended basically this the same reasoning to fermionic spin chains. I think actually most of these things, of course, this full classification of SPT phases for fermionic spin chains was already known. I think especially Fitkovsky and Kitaev wrote a beautiful paper on that. But it has never been done within this completely within this language of matrix product states. And to extend this to these fermions, you have to actually use or introduce something that's called graded tensor networks. Okay, or which kind of represent Majorana chains, and then you can really go systematically through the whole exercise, and there's many interesting things that immediately pop out there. So for example, the fact that this fermionic matrix product state without parity are incompatible with U1 particles conservation. You can see this. It's impossible to write down somehow such a matrix product state with these things that has like a global U1 particle symmetry and is gapped. And then because we believe that actually all these states represent only the gapped ones, that's why somehow Majorana edge mode, somehow you can only get them in superconductors. So kind of these are claims that are not completely obvious, but once you rephrase them in the language of matrix product states, they are directly there. You don't have to kind of think very much. Okay, so it's clear that this fundamental theorem is powerful. So what's the generalization to 2D? Okay, so we don't have a theorem. We have no idea how to prove this, but nevertheless, we can kind of assume that this is the case and see what the consequences would be. And that's basically the rest of my talk is exactly about this. So what is the generalization of this fundamental theorem in two dimensions? It means I have a PEPS described by some tensors AI. I have another one described by tensors BI. When are they equal to each other? Well, the kind of, you see this arrow is only in one direction because we cannot prove the other direction. Okay, so there's lots of conditions that have to be applied, but nevertheless, just assuming that is the case, you will find that you can derive lots of interesting states and lots of interesting properties, and most of the non-chiral topological phase in two dimensions can immediately kind of be recovered by starting from this and then systematically kind of doing all the calculations. And actually, as you will see later in the talk, you can of course also define a three-dimensional version of this, and this should be related to all these kind of three-dimensional talks that we have seen, but this is still very preliminary. We don't really have much results there yet. Okay, so what is this kind of red line? So I have not really explained. Somehow you have a tensor now, a PEPS, with four indices and another one. Well, they are, this state is equal to the other one if and only there exists something that is called a matrix product operator. So you see this red thing is not just acting on these black kind of degrees of freedom, but it also has some new red degrees of freedom. Okay, and that means that actually to relate these two things to each other, you must introduce something like a Wilson loop that purely acts on the virtual level, on the virtual degrees of freedom, and somehow that by pulling this kind of thing, this means that you can pull this thing through, and if you kind of pull this thing from here to here, you kind of change an A into a B. Well, you kind of take this red line and pull it to the right, and you see that you convert all these A tensors into B tensors. So that's why this arrow from right to left is kind of trivial, and this is exactly somehow what we will study now. So you saw that actually the whole classification of SPT phases in 1D was basically based on how can we kind of understand the representation theory of somehow these symmetries on the virtual level. Well, here it's clear we have to kind of study the representation theory of these red kind of lines, these matrix product operators on the virtual level. So what is a matrix product operator? Well, it's exactly the same thing as a matrix product state, but it has actually it's also legs above and below. So it's an operator instead of a matrix product state. Okay, so let's apply this to kind of SPT phases, assuming that this theorem is true, that somehow you can immediately kind of construct phases like that. We say, okay, if I have a state with a global symmetry, okay, so that means that if I apply this global symmetry on every kind of physical site, then there must exist somehow one of these matrix product operators that I can pull through that somehow will relate these two tensors to each other. Okay, and it's obvious that somehow these matrix product operators that are now like big kind of things, they have to form some kind of a representation, maybe a projective representation of the original group UG. So it means that if I have like a group element lambda and multiply with another group element mu, well, somehow this has to be equal to somehow the matrix product operator with group element lambda mu. But of course, these are nothing more than matrix product states. So you can apply the fundamental theorem of matrix product states to this kind of thing, and that's actually the only thing we have to do. And actually, this fundamental theorem of matrix product states is nothing more, it's kind of equivalent to something like a zipper condition. Okay, it tells you that if I have two of these, I have a lambda and a mu, then there exists something like a fusion tensor that if I can pull this through, I get lambda mu. This is actually equivalent to this thing. That means that if you start with a chain of lambdas and mus, there exists some kind of an object that you can zip through the thing like this, and somehow this transforms all these lambda mus to the lambda mu. And now, of course, you can immediately say, this kind of object X has to satisfy some associativity conditions. Otherwise, this whole thing cannot be kind of consistent. You say, now, if I kind of first kind of zip between A and B, and then through C, this must be equivalent to the other kind of way. So it must mean that there exists some kind of a transformation between these tensors and these tensors. They must be related by some F symbols. Of course, these will be exactly the F symbols that you kind of get in tensor fusion category, but of course we didn't make use of this at all. We just kind of systematically try to understand how these matrix product operator algebras kind of occur here. So actually this very similar kind of formulas was certainly kind of already invented by Xi Chen and collaborators, and this allowed them exactly somehow this connection between somehow symmetries on the virtual level and on the physical level by relating somehow the SPT phases in 3D to somehow the third cohomology of these kind of things. And indeed, somehow these F symbols are exactly kind of related to three co-cycles in the case of groups, and that's why they are completely classified by this third cohomology. Okay, so what they did more, Xi Chen, they also kind of tried to understand somehow how the symmetries act on the virtual level. So just to come back to the talk of Norbert, so he stressed a lot that somehow PEPS yield a Hilbert space somehow for these edge degrees of freedom, for the entanglement degrees of freedom. Somehow you just have all these things. Well, to get an edge theory, you can really have associate a Hilbert space with the tensor product state, with the tensor product structure to your edge modes by just leaving these things out, and you get the tensor product structure. And now by this kind of SPT kind of MPO connection, you see that if I apply my global symmetry on my state, this is equivalent to just applying my matrix product operator symmetry on my edge. Okay, and then by making use again of this fundamental theorem, you can actually see that if you have such an edge that transforms according to a non-trivial co-cycle, tri-co-cycle, then somehow it's impossible that somehow their matrix product state would be an eigenstate of such kind of an edge theory. And that's exactly kind of a proof that you will have like protected gapless excitations in SPT phases. So this immediately follows somehow from the fact that these matrix product operators have some non-trivial kind of structure. Okay, so you can ask, I'm sure that most of the people that know all this, they say, well, we know all this, this is all kind of, we don't need to know this, because we understand this in our kind of language, but I don't understand the language, that's why we do it like this. But there's more you can do. Okay, so we can obtain, so I think it's very interesting that we really get somehow a tensor product structure for the edge mode. So we can really kind of identify somehow the borders of our theory by saying, this is the Hilbert space of my edge theories. And with the entanglement spectrum, we have much more than the entanglement spectrum in such theories. We can actually also associate eigenvectors to it. Okay, so of course we can also go away from somehow randomization group points. Somehow these symmetries, we can certainly perturb all the tensors that we have in many ways in such a way that we preserve the symmetries. And that's a way of associating or introducing correlation lengths, string tension, and all these kind of things. And then you will be able to go through and study phase transitions between topological phases or two different kind of SPT phases or topological phases and so further. And somehow this thing also allows for a systematic approach to construct non-trivial phases of matter. Okay, so what we will kind of concentrate on from now on is really kind of trying to study what are these matrix product operator algebras, what are the conditions, what can we do with this. And we'll see that this kind of leads in a very natural way to all the string nets. I will not talk about SCT phases, but this should also certainly be possible. And I will kind of briefly talk about fermionic PEPs, like this toric code states using such a language. It turns out that it's very, very easy to understand all these, a subset of the fermionic PEPs, namely the ones that don't have Majorana kind of loops in terms of these graded matrix product operators that I talked about before. So what is the program from the last, how much time do I have left? Like. Oy, that's not enough. But anyway, I want to basically recover something like, so what you see is that the symmetries on the virtual level on the entanglement degrees of freedom will be encoded by some matrix product operators. Okay, and these symmetries are really local symmetries. They are related to this pulling through equation. There is this fundamental theorem of PEPs. It's a local condition. Okay, so you recover somehow this way of classifying phases of matter by local symmetries. You indeed recover this ID by just looking at the local tensors. Okay, and the second thing I would like to explain in the remaining 10 minutes is actually how onions and these topological and the truly topological theories arise very naturally in such a tensor network framework. You will see that this has to do with somehow another algebra of matrix product operators. Okay, so before we really talk about constructing all these topological theories like string nets in terms of matrix product operators, let me go back to somehow something that all of you know, and that is that if you have a topologically ordered system, like a two-dimensional system, and you calculate the entanglement entropy of a region, then there is something always this kind of topological entanglement entropy correction. Okay, and we'd like to kind of relate this exactly to this matrix product operator algebra. So what this kind of entanglement entropy correction tells you is that there's some kind of an entanglement, there's a deficiency of entanglement. There's less entanglement in this region than you would expect. Now it turns out that these matrix product operators, these symmetries on the virtual level, are exactly kind of telling you, yes, indeed, this object lives in a certain subspace, namely the subspace that has the symmetries of this matrix product operator. And that's exactly how somehow this whole idea, of course, started. That's how we kind of started thinking about this. So in particular, if you have like one of these topological order systems, and there is indeed somehow a matrix product operator that you can put around it, that leaves this kind of thing invariant. Okay, so to come back to somehow the picture of SPT, that means that there is actually a sufficient condition for having such a structure, is that indeed the tensors have some kind of a matrix product operator symmetry. Namely that if you have this tensor here and there is one of these kind of matrix product operators, I can pull it through without changing the tensor. So before, in the SPT case, when we pull this thing through, we had to actually have some action on the physical level. But here there's no action at all on the physical level. It's purely somehow a virtual symmetry. Okay? And now the fundamental theorem of these matrix product operators or matrix product states can be used to characterize somehow the consistency conditions that you have to satisfy such that this is true. Okay, so let me kind of give a simple example. The example that you all know is like the toric code. I have a matrix-blocked operator projector of dimension 2, but it turns out to be a completely trivial one. So this example was actually found. I should have kind of put a reference here to the work of Ignacio, Norbert, and David. Somehow they constructed this matrix-blocked operator for all possible quantum doubles, and this was really the start for all this work. So it turns out that these matrix-blocked operator projectors in terms of these red indices are trivial. They are like just direct sums of different objects. That means that these kind of the red index is not really there. Okay, so it's just a kind of a product. So it means that, for example, you act with a Z here, well, this is equivalent to acting with three Zs there. This is exactly like Norbert talked about. Okay, so what are the consistency conditions? Because that's somehow what we want to do now. We say, okay, these matrix-blocked operators, they seem to capture somehow the symmetries of your topological theory. What more can we say? Okay, so obviously these matrix-blocked operators, they have to be projectors. P squared is P. That means that if somehow this P is a direct sum of blocks, like we just saw in the case of the toric coat, it's a direct sum of two kind of completely different blocks of bond dimension one. Well, somehow if you square this, this has to be equal to the original one, and then you use this fundamental theorem of matrix product state to say, that means that there must exist something like a fusion tensor that relates blocks of the product of two to somehow the original ones. Okay, because that's nothing more than saying that indeed P squared is equal to P. This is the product of this. So you have to think this is this infinite thing here, and this is one. But the sum, somehow the product of these two must be the sum of these two, and therefore somehow there must exist something like fusion tensors that satisfy this. Okay, so then the next thing is that we require the projector to be Hermitian. So that means that, again, by the same theorem, somehow for every block, somehow with a certain kind of label A, there must consist another block, namely A star, which is basically the complex conjugate, that kind of that is corresponding to it. Otherwise, the sum of these things could never be Hermitian. And in many cases, of course, this A star is equal to A, and then this means that there's some kind of an extra condition on these blocks, namely that somehow this transformation that transforms one block to the conjugate, somehow, well, this X, somehow this thing, this X has, or this Z here, has to satisfy some kind of a condition, and you see immediately that Z times C bar has to be equal to somehow a constant times the identity, and this constant can only be plus or minus one. This turns out to be somehow the Frobenius-Schur indicator that somehow people familiar with tensor fusion category kind of will immediately kind of recognize. Okay, but of course, this is all kind of principally independent from this tensor fusion category, but somehow it's clear that all of these things, I think most of the people already see where this thing is going to. At the end, we were hoping that we would find new kind of topological phases. Turns out that actually we cannot go beyond somehow the framework that was already known. Okay, so we can start playing games now, like, okay, let's look at the associativity of these F symbols. Okay, so if this tensor has to be equal to this one, well, that means that there must exist an F that satisfies this. Of course, if you are more precise, you have to put arrows. I will not do this. And then somehow there's some kind of the next step. Somehow you have to actually make some assumptions to continue. And it turns out that these assumptions to continue are kind of very much related to conditions that you need to have kind of a system, to have basically unity tensor fusion categories. So for example, you have to assume that these isometries, these fusion tensors are isometries. Actually, we have to assume something a little bit stronger than somehow this than this fundamental theorem. We have to assume that actually these fusion tensors satisfy that. Actually, I don't have to put one to the left. Now I can kind of zip one of these things through this other one. And in the matrix product state kind of language, this means that it cannot be trash vectors. Okay, and this is something you have to exclude. Otherwise, somehow we don't know how to deal with those. And there's also something that is related to this Frobenius-Schur indicator thing that the previous slide. Maybe we have to assume something like a pivotal structure. Okay, and this, of course, these are conditions that are not that unnatural. If you kind of play around with this matrix product operator, it's clear that if these conditions are not satisfied, you cannot continue. Okay, that's why somehow we assume this. But I think this is certainly makes the whole formula a little bit weaker, because at the end we have to assume things that are very similar to what people in tensor fusion category have to assume. Although these tensors in principle are still completely free. Okay, so and then you basically have all these blocks, you can do another kind of associativity game, and you see that indeed somehow you recover immediately the pentagon equation. And that, of course, immediately forces these kind of tensors to be very, very special. No? So once you have this pentagon equation, you know that there's only a finite number of solutions, or essentially different solutions. And that means that at the end, these matrix product operator algebras that we kind of started from, they are classified by some kind of a triple that is just related to indeed how the product of matrix product operators relates to each other, to this F symbol, and actually to this Schur-Frobenius operators. Okay, so this is, I know you have to work backwards, okay? This is the conditions on these F symbols. Now it turns out that all these other conditions can be rephrased in terms of the same kind of F symbol. So it's very similar, the philosophy, as what people in the Beta-Ansatz do, okay? They come up with some kind of an algebra of in the algebraic framework of the Beta-Ansatz. They come up with some matrix product operators that commute with each other, and then they find basically these Young-Bachstra equations, and then they find solutions of the Young-Bachstra equations, and then they see if I kind of plug this solution of the Young-Bachstra equations in the original matrix product operators, I actually find the solution. That's called the fundamental kind of representation of the Young-Bachstra. Well, here we can do exactly the same. There's many, many more solutions, of course, but one particularly simple solution for finding matrix product operators that satisfy all these rules is by defining them themselves in terms of these kind of F symbols. And actually, this G is some kind of a symmetrized version of these F symbols. That means that we can immediately write down somehow PEPs wave functions that would satisfy all these rules. It turns out that these are exactly in the same phase as all these kind of Levin and Wendt models. Okay, so there's of course lots of kind of tensor fusion category ways of understanding this. So what at the end what we do turns out to be some related to somehow you have some input category, then you calculate the Drinfield center of this input category, and this gives rise to this whole kind of formulas of matrix product operators and so further. And of course there's many things you can prove, because this is a very rigid framework, this whole kind of matrix product and PEPs framework. We can prove that indeed somehow the degeneracy, that there exists a Hamiltonian for which is the ground state, that the degeneracy of the ground state subspace does not grow with the system size, and so further. This is all kind of things you can actually pretty easily do. But of course, what I have not talked about, and I would like to talk about this in the last 5 minutes, is how to construct anions, okay? Because this is something that's actually not trivial also in the original formulation of Levin and Wendt. What are actually really the topological sectors? And can you kind of really find the resolution of the identity in terms of all the different topological sectors? Okay, so we would like to understand basically what the elementary excitations are in the system. So I have my kind of PEPs, and I would like to understand what are the properties, or how can I construct anions in my theory, really physical anions? How do I have to represent them in my kind of system? And it's clear that anions have to come with one of these strings that you can pull through the lattice, so they are invisible where they are, because indeed the energy somehow, if you calculate the energy here, this should not be dependent on whether there's a string there or not. So somehow the way we construct at the end in this fundamental representation our PEPs wave function is really by taking exactly the same objects like we started from and just saying these are my physical indices, the outer indices are my virtual indices. That's a projector, and turns out that this of course satisfies all the rules, because this is exactly the projector you started from. Okay, so how to get an anion? So we need an extra index, okay? Because obviously there is an index that kind of gets out of this anion that has to be connected to another one, because you cannot just have one anion in your system. So what you do is basically somehow try to find what objects do we have here that you would be able to put there such that there's an index in. But it turns out that somehow the right way of looking at this is not saying that I would just want an index out, let me also put an index in, because this is at the end, we can still put some kind of physical projector on this middle thing. The only thing that happens or that is important is actually the symmetries of this object. And then you see that somehow we indeed have natural objects, namely these fusion tensors. You just put two of these fusion tensors there, one that comes in here, one that comes there, and we kind of take this as somehow an ansatz for our anions. And it turns out that this is exactly the right ansatz. So what you have here is now somehow an object with five indices. You have five indices in the middle, four black ones and one red one. And on the outside, you also have four indices and one four black indices and one red one. And you can easily prove that this thing itself forms a C-star algebra. That means if you take any kind of linear combination of such objects and multiply somehow on the inside with somehow that other thing, you get again a linear combination of these objects. And it turns out, I don't understand this yet, but people tell me that this is very similar to somehow Acniani's tube algebra. And indeed, somehow, what happens is that the anions of your theory turns out to be somehow the central idempotence of this algebra. So at the end, this is very easy, no? So we have these tensors, we just put them in our computer and calculate somehow the central idempotence, and you basically get somehow projectors that turn out to be exactly related to measuring the charge of your anion, and all the different anions in your output category seems to be of that kind of form. Okay, so let me give a small example. In the case of the toric coat, this is all kind of very simple. Somehow the only tensors that we have are identities, sigma z's. Turns out that somehow the different anions, we have four different idempotents that correspond to I plus z without a string of z, because this string is not there. This would kind of be one, then you have the electric. It would be one minus z, But without string also, then you have the magnetic is 1 plus Z, like the original, but with the string attached to it, and then somehow the particle that actually is the fermion in the toric code. Of course, you can play the game for any other model, so you can immediately kind of take any of these string nets, you can immediately write down this algebra, and you do this, you put this in a computer, and you get somehow this idempotence out. And I don't think this is, I don't know exactly how to do this in any other language, but somehow in this matrix product operator language, this is very, very simple. And the power of this formalism kind of reveals itself immediately if you kind of start asking questions like, what is the topological spin? Okay, so it's clear that somehow this object with this blue thing was my onion. And what is the topological spin? It's really taking somehow your spin and rotating it over 360 degrees and seeing how you relate it to the original one. Well, what is this thing? Well, there's a string that was getting out of your theory. Well, you just take this string, wind it around this. And because these kind of things all form come out of an algebra, you can relate this thing to the original one, and you immediately get your face out. Okay, so it's like a one line. You can do this for the toric code, for the Fibonacci, and of course you get what you expect. So what is fusion? Well, it's also very natural in this language. No, you have like two of these kind of onions. You kind of can fuse them, but this fusion operator puts somehow this idempotent around it and measures somehow basically what topological sector you are. Braiding, well, exactly the same. You kind of take somehow you relate. Say I have some blue string somewhere to my lattice. I have an onion here. I want to pull somehow. I want to represent this state actually by something that looks like this because that's more convenient for me. Well, then you have to put a tensor here, and it turns out that this tensor can be immediately obtained and is actually exactly the same idempotent as the ones that defined your onions. And this, of course, will also be the one that completely characterizes the ground state degeneracy on the torus. Okay, so can you give me like two more minutes? So what is the topological entanglement entropy in this case? Okay, so let's calculate the topological entanglement entropy indeed in a region in which there is an anion. Okay, so it's clear that if you have an anion in this region, and I want to calculate the topological entanglement entropy in this kind of region, well, somehow this thing is in a topological sector, of course, with an anion. So that means that this thing will live in a subspace characterized by this idempotence. And you can do this calculation, and you take basically the limit of this system going to infinity, and you see that indeed the rank of the projector on which you kind of do this, or the rank on which this project, so this idempotent is defined, so the row rank of that kind of idempotent is exactly somehow something that scales with the size of it's exponential in the size of this thing, but there's some kind of a correction, and this correction turns out to be exactly somehow the topological kind of charge of that anion in the inside. And of course, this is very much related to somehow this Ludwig Affleck entropy for boundary CFTs, because somehow what this thing is, indeed, you have this string, and it ends somewhere on this boundary. It turns out that this should be related in one or the other way to this kind of choosing non-trivial kind of boundary CFTs, because somehow this anion has to kind of end somewhere on the boundary, otherwise this is not a well-defined theory. And of course, the result that Affleck and Ludwig get is exactly these quantum dimensions that come out of this. Okay, so as I already said, somehow, if you're interested in topological sectors in the ground state, well, this thing is exactly the same, so you have to put somehow, all the ground states can be obtained by putting a loop like this. What do you put somehow where these two loops meet? It's again the same idempotent. What is a Dane twist? A Dane twist is actually, in this language, I think, much more intuitive than really having to take your system, twisting it and kind of putting it again to each other. What you have to do here is just kind of twist the red string. You don't have to kind of twist the system. You only have to twist basically kind of this virtual somehow symmetry of your thing. So you kind of just wind it around your torus and never kind of really twist your torus itself. And that immediately gives you somehow ways of calculating this S and T matrices. Another cool thing, and this was one of the original motivations for kind of looking at somehow these tensor networks, was to understand quantum computation. Okay, it turns out that somehow these PEPS wave functions you can really understand in terms of, you can understand that actually measurement-based quantum computation is somehow acting on the entanglement degrees of freedom. It turns out that if you kind of write down now, let's say, a braiding onions in your topological theory in terms of these PEPs and in terms of especially these matrix product operators, it turns out that the logical qubits are nothing more than somehow these entanglement degrees of freedom. So you can associate really a tensor product structure to somehow the topological quantum computation that you do. And these kind of degrees of freedom are, of course, kind of locally, they're like a nice tensor product structure locally on the virtual level, but on the physical level, they are very non-local. And I think I just want to say, like, a few seconds that, of course, you can do the same thing for fermionic taps. Because somehow we have this fermionic matrix product states, well, you can immediately write down fermionic matrix product operators. You can kind of go through the same discussion. You see that somehow if this somehow you have to associate, the only difference is that you have to attach a parity to every anion label, and then you get somehow this modified pentagon equations that is called the super pentagon equation of Gu and Wen. This all comes very, very naturally. You can start kind of classifying fermionic SPTs by solving this, and you can do the same thing in three dimensions. These are students. So Burak, if you want to know more about this, Burak Sahinoglu is just finished his PhD and is writing kind of several papers on this, but I don't know when they will be online. But somehow it really has to do everything with somehow a generalization of this fundamental theorem that somehow it's very much related actually to the Zamolodnikov way of solving the beta ansatz. Okay, there's this kind of generalization of beta ansatz to three dimensions due to Zamolodnikov, and somehow it has to do with symmetries of tensors. Well, this kind of equations have lots of things to do with this, and it's very nice to do this in this framework. Okay, so I think I will stop here. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Frank.
I have many questions, but I'll stick to three. So first is, as long as Levin-Wen models are concerned, the labels on the MPO turns out to be the same as the original string labels, and their algebra is also pretty, like, exactly the same. So the equations you wrote, it's pretty much the same equations in the original model.
Indeed. And now, as you saw, there are really two distinct algebras. We have the algebra of the matrix product operators, which is the input category, but then we had like another algebra for this idempotence. And this is actually the algebra that completely determines the output category, namely the theory of the real anions that you will have in your double theory.
Exactly the same thing happens in Levin-Wen model also, that you have the original string labels, and then
again I'm not saying that actually in this whole talk I said anything new. Okay, I'm sure that that many people in the audience know everything I said in a much, much more deeper way than I do. But I just want to understand these things in the language of matrix product operators and not matrix product states. And what the claim that I want to make is that this is a very natural way of looking at it in this way. And this also lends itself easily to generalizations, like to you want to do fermions, you want to go to three dimensions. Well, this seems to be a very natural language. You can also kind of start putting correlations. So this is the framework. So I'm really indeed rephrasing something that most of you already know very well in this language.
And it's not just equal to going to a dual description, like to a dual lattice where now my strings run kind of dual to the original strings. It's not going to this MPO language is not just equal to doing that.
No. Well, in principle, we didn't start at all from anything like tensor fusion. No, we just said we have a PEPS, we have some kind of symmetries. Let's try to understand what kind of the implications are of imposing that there's some symmetries in this lattice.
Let me just ask the last question. So these MPO symmetries, it seems that they just come from the Wilson loop operators of anions, right? That if an anion goes around, the state has to be symmetric under that operation. Is it true that the MPO symmetries are originally coming from anionic symmetries?
Yes, but there's a big difference between these MPO symmetries and actually the original Wilson loops. If you perturb your theory away from somehow a fixed point, then Wilson loops to remain symmetries, you have to fatten them. No? You really have to adiabatically kind of change them, and they become really very, very broad. These things, even if you perturb your system away, they remain exact symmetries. So there's no kind of, so you don't have to worry about your Wilson loops to kind of get, because exactly the right language of these Wilson loops is probably not the real space, because you have to kind of adiabatically change them to kind of cover some broader and broader thing. No, they are actually the virtual symmetries, the things that live on the kind of entanglement degrees of freedom.
I was wondering if you could comment on whether this, could be useful computationally in the sense that, suppose that I give you a Hamiltonian. So there's two things I could imagine. Suppose I give you a Hamiltonian and I want you to tell me what phase it's in, first of all. And second of all, suppose that, I start with a string net Hamiltonian and I add some other terms and I want, to know if it's still in the same phase or something like that. Can you actually code this and use it to do useful numerical simulations?
Yes, so let me go back to the one slide on numerics that I had. because that's exactly what somehow we did there. This one. So this turns out to be an interpolation between the string net, the Fibonacci string net, and actually this is exactly the what some people call the Fendley model, which has a certain correlation length, and then you go further to the phase transition. So we kind of try to indeed to see what happens if you add some kind of string tension through your on your kind of label. And what you see is that somehow this is actually the excitation. It's very similar to somehow what people kind of discussed in the previous talk. This is actually somehow the correlation function, but you can interpret this as a spectrum. It turns out that these white dots, this is basically this is the excitation energy needed to construct one of these tau bar anions in the Fibonacci model or in the Fendley model. And when you kind of get closer and closer to the phase transition, you see that actually this thing really start touching zero, and exactly when this kind of is at zero, you have a condensation of these tau bar anions. And indeed, we studied exactly this kind of thing. But it's very subtle. You cannot start studying these things if you don't know about this whole formalism. You really know you have to impose always these matrix product operator symmetries and all these things. So without this formalism, we would not be able to do this. Indeed, so that's why it's dangerous now to study indeed topological theories without, if you don't understand the structure, the symmetries of the structure, you perturb a little bit the tensor somehow. Immediately, somehow, all the topological features is lost. And actually, I think Leon even wrote a paper on that, I think last year, where he kind of discusses that. And indeed, it's very dangerous with variational ancestors. If you don't know the symmetries, that somehow a tiny perturbation might kind of bring you in a completely different phase if you don't take care of this. And so you have to kind of indeed put this whole framework in this, and you have to kind of see this frame. But indeed, somehow, of course, you can also do variational calculations with these states. And then indeed, look in different sectors. You kind of say, let in this sector, what is the lowest energy, and another sector, what is the lowest energy, and then compare these things. So it is really possible to do numerics with this, yes.
Okay, any other question? Well, if not, there is now a break, and so thank you. And we'll come back in half an hour.